Hey, Fidelity, can I get a second opinion on stocks in the Fidelity app?
With Fidelity, it's easy to get an outside opinion from independent experts in a single score.
And then?
When you're ready, trade U.S. stocks and ETFs with no commissions.
That's right.
I am always right.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Sell order assessment fee not included. A limited number of ETFs are subject to a transaction-based service fee of $100. See full list at fidelity.com/commissions. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you very much, Scott. Hi, everybody. I'm Kelly Evans, and here's what's ahead this hour on The Exchange. Trick or treat, stocks reverse higher today, even after Apple and Amazon failed to inspire investors. The NASDAQ and the S&P 500, like Scott was just pointing out, they're at fresh record highs, even as earnings season so far has been a mixed bag. We'll have all the very latest. Plus, crypto banking. The FDIC considering how it can allow traditional banks to hold cryptocurrencies on their balance sheets and for customers. Former FDIC Chair Sheila Bair joins us to tell us what she likes about this plan and what she really doesn't. Plus, celebrity chef Bobby Flay will get his take on food prices, labor costs, and the supply chain, and he'll tell us about his latest foray. But we begin with the markets and those huge tech earnings. Take a walk with me. Let's quickly check out the lay of the land here. The Dow is up about 65 points at this hour. We've seen a turnaround from the declines earlier on. The S&P just a point below 4,600, which it crossed above for the first time today, also at a record intraday high. Here are some big stars. Oh, see, this is why Dom does this. These two stars down here are correct for the S&P and the NASDAQ. The Dow itself, I don't believe, has been at an intraday record high yet, but it's just a matter of time these days. This is the flip side as well of falling yields. Take a look at the activity over the past week. You can see, again, the 10-year note hovering around 1.57%, so a big decline from almost 1.7% last week. Even as we keep getting more warnings about inflation, we'll tell you what we just heard from Bill Ackman in just a moment. The stocks of the day are Apple and Amazon, the two tech giants disappointing on earnings. Supply chain issues weighing on both companies. It's the first time since 2017 that Apple's revenue missed estimates, but they are off the lows here. You can see this lift that's been taking place throughout the session today. Apple's down 2% right now. Amazon down less than 3%. Apple's decline is helping Microsoft surpass Apple today as the world's most valuable company. So just an extraordinary rebound for Microsoft this year. And now it gets to enjoy this superlative, at least for a period of time. All right. Another victim of supply chain woes is Western Digital. It's sinking after providing weaker than expected guidance. Here's an 8% drop. I'm sorry, for WDC today. There we go. And for Starbucks, which is also down a similar magnitude, the bigger issue is wage inflation. The company is saying spending on wages will depress its profit margins next year and that it expects to raise prices to compensate. Again, more than a 7% drop for Starbucks today. All of this said, today is the actual halfway point in earnings season. Bob Bassani is here with a granular look at the trends. Bob, what we've learned from earnings so far and the stock reaction to it.
Yeah. And Kelly, there are two main trends and takeaways here. Number one, demand is strong across all industry. That's the number one takeaway. And secondly, you heard about those supply chain issues. They're trying to navigate with them against them. Some of them are more successful than others. I think the most important thing is profit margins are a tad lower, but still very strong, close to historic levels. Earnings growth still there, but the guidance is slowing down a little bit. If you look at the fourth quarter, that's what we care about right now. We're going to be up close to 23% in earnings growth. That's pretty good, but nothing close to what we had earlier in the year. And the amount that's been going up in the last few weeks, much smaller than it was earlier in the year when we saw big jumps as we head into the front month quarter here. So not quite as enthusiastic as they were earlier in the year. Two big issues out there. Are supply chain worries peaking now and in the next quarter or not? And pricing power. How long can corporate America keep raising prices like this? The street's trying to convince itself that most of these worries are temporary. Look at L3 Harris's CEO, Chris Kubasik. He said, we ultimately view these pandemic-related impacts as temporary and remain focused on creating value for our shareholders over the long term. So here's what's valuable and important, Kelly. Margins. That's what powers the stock market. We had historic high margins in the second quarter, 13.5%, 13% earlier in the year. We're probably going to be in the 12% range. That is not bad at all, considering, Kelly, the average profit margins for the S&P has been 8% going back almost 30 years. So the profit margins have been going up, Kelly, because earnings are rising faster than the revenues here. Bottom line here is more revenues are going to the bottom line. because corporate America is just getting more efficient. They're cutting costs out. And the question now is, when are people going to push back against these price hikes that the corporations are getting? I'll bet you you're going to have a problem by the second half. This isn't going to keep going. You're going to get people who are going to just say, enough is enough. I'm not spending this for a chocolate bar or a defense contract or whatever. You're going to start getting pushed back.
I hear the same thing. Bob, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Our Bob Pisani. Meantime, new data this morning do show what's going on with these inflationary pressures across the economy. A key inflation gauge closely followed by the Fed surging to a more than 30-year high. The PCE price index rising 0.3% last month and up 4.4% on the year. That's the most since 1991. My next guest has been warning about inflation for some time. So how should investors play it? Joining me now is Randall Ely. He is the president and chief investment officer at the Edgar Lomax Company. Randall, it's great to see you again. What do you make of this environment?
It's great to see you also.
What do you make of this environment, Randall?
I think the developments that are happening are pretty much what we were talking about a year ago. I will not claim to have been so prescient that I saw exactly how it would happen. I didn't know that the supply chain problem would be this bad. But let's face it, we've known for a long time that historically, inflation pressures are building up when the economy is reaching various levels of imbalances.
So let's talk about how you think investors should play that. You know, there's the point that Bob Pisani was just making, which is this is actually seeing a time of expanding profit margins, but yet some, you know, some high profile companies are struggling these days.
Yes. As you know, I'm a value investor and have believed in value for the long run as a better and safer way to invest for most investors anyway. Nothing against growth. I'm just talking about for the long run, because however exciting returns may be for a 1 or 2 year period with any investment strategy, long-term investors are going to be in for the rest of their lives. So I think we need to assume that interest rates are going to be going up. In the long run, that's the key element, I think, in the solution for inflation, which includes the various supply chain problems we're seeing now.
The tricky thing I was just going to say about looking for those value companies you describe is people wanting to avoid value traps. I think we talked about AT&T in the past, and I'm curious if that's still a name that you like.
Well, I was hoping you wouldn't bring that up. I say that kiddingly, but AT&T was one stock in a total portfolio, and as you all know, they're going through a restructuring that I think bodes well for that investment in the long run. But we have other names, you know, some of which have been doing very well. I mean, CVS Health, for example, has done quite well since the last show when we, back in March, I think it was, when we recommended them. And I think, in addition, you know, MetLife is a name I was planning to talk about today.
Absolutely. And no. So, and we can see that those, you know, MetLife up 36% this year, CVS up 20%. Let me just point out a warning that we've just received from Bill Ackman, the hedge fund, what do we call them, owner, operator, on Twitter. Here's his tweet. He says he just gave a presentation to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York last week to share his views about inflation and Fed policy. The bottom line, we think the Fed should taper immediately and begin raising rates as soon as possible. Randall, what would happen if the Fed did have to play catch up here by raising rates? I mean, we are seeing, look at what's happened with Australian bond yields, you know, on the shorter term, or other parts of the globe. Germany's 10 years almost going to turn positive. Could we see a much bigger reset with rates if the Fed is behind the curve and has to play catch up?
There's no doubt. If they suddenly have to move quickly, there is a greater chance of a severe recession as opposed to a common garden variety one. But the fact of life is, no matter how they do it, the job of removing QE and then raising rates, it's going to be a very difficult job for the Fed this time around. I wish them well. And they have emitted any number of signals that they are about to start. So let's see how fast they get on with it. But sooner or later, if developments keep up as it will, they're going to have to speed up the pace.
Yeah, it's, I think, a warning that a lot of people are thinking about right now, and your picks certainly reflect a world that might be moving in that direction. Randall, it's great to see you. Thanks again for your time today.
Yeah, thank you, too.
Randall Ely with the Edgar Lomax Company. Well, we are closing out the year much the way it began, with this value-tinted trade. Energy and financials are the two best-performing groups over the past 3 months, up 15 and 10% respectively. Communications services is the biggest laggard and the only sector in the red in that time span. Dom Chu has a closer look at what's been ailing it. Dom?
Well, the companies that really matter, those big social media companies, the ones with the biggest market caps, are the ones that have been driving things lower. And as you can see here, you mentioned the three-week span. On a year-to-date basis, it's also been an underperformer after outperforming. The orange line is the communication services sector. For the better part of this year, it's been above that white line, but only in the last couple of weeks here has it really kind of tilted the other direction. And there's a reason why, because of those big social media companies. But let's take a look at what's been kind of helping matters out for the overall sector so far. Now, many of these names are doing very well on a year-to-date basis. Alphabet, the most important of which, is up 65%. It's such a huge market cap, so it plays a lot in terms of influence on the market overall for communication services. IPG, Fox, Live Nation, News Corp, among the names that are all up very well over the course of the year-to-date period, helping to drive the action to the upside. Now, on the downside, some of the biggest laggards so far this year have been, you mentioned AT&T in that last segment there. You can see AT&T down 12%. Take-Two Interactive down 13%, T-Mobile, Activision Blizzard, and Discovery. So many of these media companies, video game publishers, have been real drags on the overall sector so far. But I will point this out because there are values out there. At some point, there could be performance to the downside enough to where some of these stocks may appear attractive. Now, momentum names like Amazon, or Alphabet rather, up 10%, have been a real leader over the last month. Netflix has also been a big leader, two very big mega cap names. But take a look at Take-Two. One of the biggest laggards on a year-to-date basis over the last month is up 19%. That's the white line there. So at some point, Kelly, things could drop enough to where some investors say maybe things have gotten bad enough. Let's step into buy. You're seeing some of those signs with Take-Two Interactive right now. We'll see if it plays out with other video game publishers as well. Kel, back over to you.
I still think the fact that a video game company is in something called communication services means these sector names need to continue to evolve.
Right.
Dom, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Dom Chu on the movers there. Those are some of the movers in the worst performing sector this month. Here's a look at the top stocks in the top sector, which is energy. APA, Marathon, Halliburton, EOG, and Occidental all jumping between 14 and 23%. Obviously benefiting from crude's 10% rally this month. And still ahead, construction, crypto, cooking, and cruises. The CEO of Meritage Homes joins us next to discuss the housing market. Then former FDIC Chair Sheila Bair on whether or not banks should hold crypto assets. Plus, Bobby Flay is cooking up a surprising new business venture. We'll talk to him about that. And the CEO of Royal Caribbean is here, fresh off earnings, to talk the future of the industry and their new 274-day cruise. A whole lot more coming up right after this.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Support for this program is provided by Chevron. Demand for energy is projected to continue rising in the future. To help keep up, Chevron is increasing their U.S. oil and gas production, and they're innovating to help do it responsibly across their operations, including their Gulf of Mexico facilities, which are some of the world's lowest carbon intensity operations, helping supply energy that's affordable, reliable, and ever cleaner. That's energy in progress. Learn more at chevron.com/meetingdemand.
Welcome back, everybody. The housing market continues its wild run as yields soften again and demand for homes remains sky high. That helped Meritage Homes report earnings well above expectations. The stock up 32% on the year, taking a bit of a profit to date on a little less than 1%. The real question is whether the housing market is showing any signs yet of losing momentum. Joining me now is Meritage Homes CEO Philippe Lord. It is great to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
What is your typical price point?
Well, our average price point is right around 400. We closed right around 400, 3,000 houses this last quarter, and our average ASP was right around 400,000.
And are your prices also up about 20% in line with the national average year on year?
You know, store to store they are, but part of our strategy at Meritage Home is really to provide affordable housing. So we've been moving down price points. So a lot of the new communities that we're bringing on are at a much lower price point. So when you look at our year over year, we're really only up about 7% because our mix has really changed.
Wow. Why would you go down in terms of average selling price at a time when supply and labor chain pressures are so high?
You know, around 6 years ago, we looked at our strategy and really our focus was we felt that there was a really underbuilt part of the market, which was the affordable part of the market. We see that as any price under 400 in the markets that we build in. And so we redesigned our product. We started sourcing land and really tried to position our product in the future at a lower ASP because we felt that interest rates were going to go up. They haven't gone up yet, but we see them going up over the long term. And clearly we think that the lower price you are, the more affordable you'll be, and that's the people that are going to need homes and want to buy homes.
That's so interesting. I mean, most of our guests come on and talk about how they think, you know, bond yields are going up, so they're buying, you know, so they're not buying Amazon. I mean, you're staking your whole company on the possibility that higher yields could dent home price appreciation or affordability, and you're looking at sort of the lower price segment of the market. And I mean, would you abandon that strategy now? How is profitability going? Have you been able to absorb these pressures? And if so, how?
Well, it's going great. Last quarter or yesterday, we reported our earnings and we had the highest closing gross margin in the history of the company of 29.7. We also were able to close the 3,112 houses, which was above the guidance that we gave and the expectations out in the street. So we think our affordable play in the market allows us to manage through these supply chains, but also we're continuing to see strong housing demand where interest rates are, because that's really what people can afford as prices have escalated over the last, you know, 12 to 18 months.
I was, you know, looking at your Twitter feed. Some of the properties are beautiful. Some have solar and different features. Do you use a lot of lumber? Where have you experienced the most supply cost pressure, which those have obviously come down? And what about the delays? You know, one of the things that we're trying to understand is to what extent are delays keeping the supply of housing from increasing to meet demand? You know, is it, and are we going to end up with a glut?
Yeah, that's the real challenge, is getting product to the market, whether it's in the form of land. That's still taking long. It's extremely regulated. It's very slow to get new communities to the market. The same thing with building our houses. The input costs are up. You know all about the supply chain. Labor is constrained as well. So that's why we are very bullish about the next few years, because we just don't see a lot of supply being able to enter the market with the way supply constraints are today. And we really like our story, right? We had community count growth year over year. We now have 236 communities in across all of our markets. And we've set a goal of getting to 300 next year. And we think that gives Meritage a big opportunity to provide supply in a very supply constrained market.
I guess my final question, again, going back to your price point and looking at where in the country you operate, you know, where we are in northern New Jersey, I think it would be impossible either to get land at that price or to build at that price. So what parts of the country are still affordable and how far out do people have to go? You know, has work from home meant that the exurbs, if that's where you are, I don't know if you are, but that is much more feasible now than it would have been 10 or 15 years ago?
Yeah, you know, we build in the Smile States, California, Arizona, Colorado, Texas, Florida, Georgia, Tennessee, South Carolina, North Carolina. And we're just seeing a ton of in-migration from all the more expensive parts of the United States of America. And we are building further out, but not too far out, right? Still in areas where there's really good schools, really good infrastructure, services, and et cetera. And that's where people are moving. Is it because they can work remotely? Is it because they just have a desire to move out from dense areas into what we call the exurbs or the suburbs? I think all of it really matters. But the preference for single family detached housing right now is the highest it's ever been, in my opinion, since I've been in this business.
Amazing. Philippe Lord, thanks for joining us. And we really appreciate the color.
Thank you very much. Appreciate being here.
He is the CEO of Meritage Homes. Still ahead, the FDIC is reportedly developing a roadmap for banks to hold crypto assets. Up next, we'll hear from former FDIC Chair Sheila Bair about the right way to move forward.
Imagine earning a degree that prepares you with real skills for the real world. Capella University's programs teach skills relevant to your career, so you can apply what you learn right away. Learn how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu.
Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. S&P back above 4,600. This is the first time it's ever happened. Intraday highs today for the S&P and the NASDAQ, even though stocks in general are up anywhere between 1 2/10% right now. But here are some of the movers this hour. U.S. Steel is surging after beating earnings expectations. The company also announced a $300 million stock buyback and is increasing its dividend to 5 cents a share from 1 cent. X up 14% today. Mohawk getting a haircut after a slight miss on revenues. The company telling investors it expects challenges to continue, saying, quote, rather than improving as expected, the availability of labor, materials, and transportation became more challenging, resulting in higher costs in the period. They go on to say, for the near term, we do not foresee significant changes in these external pressures. And that gives you shares down more than 11% for their worst day since July of last year. And Zendesk, not so zen today, on pace for its worst day since March 2020 after reaching a deal to buy the parent company of SurveyMonkey, Momentum Global, for $28 a share. Well, Momentum's at 23. Analysts at Jefferies, Piper Sandler, and B of A are all downgrading Zendesk on this $4 billion deal. Axios' Dan Primack points out that it's too early to say if this will be another Zoom and Five9 situation where the stock price drop scuttled the merger, but it's not too early to think about describing it that way. As I mentioned, even Momentum is down and not anywhere near that acquisition price today. Now to Rahel Solomon for a CNBC News update. Rahel?
Hi, Kelly, and here's what's happening at this hour. President Biden met with French President Emmanuel Macron while in Rome ahead of the G20 summit. It's the first time that Biden and Macron have met face-to-face since the spat between the two countries over a submarine deal. French officials said that they felt blindsided last month by the secret U.S.-British submarine deal with Australia. And on the news, a preview of what to expect from Biden at the G20 summit this weekend. That's tonight at 7 Eastern. The FAA reportedly planning to issue warnings to pilots and airlines ahead of the rollout of a new 5G wireless service. According to the Wall Street Journal, regulators are preparing to warn about the service's potential interference with key cockpit safety systems. The new 5G service is slated to go live as soon as December. And in London, protesters taking to the streets to lobby against the use of fossil fuels. The demonstrations were joined by Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg, and they come ahead of next week's UN climate summit in Scotland. Kelly, I'll send it back to you.
Okay, Rahel, thank you. Now, crypto has been rallying all week, with Ether today hitting an all-time high above $4,400. It's up 45% this month. Bitcoin is above $60,000 again and having its best month this year, up 40%. Now, this week, regulators say they are looking to provide more clarity on banks holding cryptocurrencies as assets on their balance sheets. But if crypto isn't insured by the FDIC, who's left holding the bag if the cryptos go bust? My next guest says regulation is needed in this space, but putting so much risk on a bank's balance sheet might be the wrong answer. Joining me now is Sheila Bair, former FDIC chair. And I did not know this, but you're on the board of Paxos, the stablecoin issuer. Welcome, Sheila.
I am. Yes, thank you. Thanks for having me.
I should mention you're also the author of a series of children's books on crypto. Oh. No, I'm kidding. It's on financial literacy, but maybe crypto is now part of that money tales. There they are. So,
well, thank you for mentioning them. Yeah,
exactly. We're showing them all on the screen. Let's start with what the FDIC wants to bring into the regulatory framework. Are they going to move before the stablecoin issue is clarified or after?
I don't think so. I went back and read her speech and the interview again. They didn't completely line up. I think what she was so good that they're going to be trying to clarify all this because it's a big muddle right now. But I think these are areas where they're seeking to provide clarification. I don't think they've quite gone so far as to say, yes, it's going to be okay for banks to hold crypto on their balance sheets. But that is one of the issues they want to clarify and provide an answer for.
You know, I think the banks are sitting there and going, well, wait a minute. We have enormous growth in fintech and these crypto platforms and all of this. You know, our users, the community, they want to use these services, but they obviously want to do so in a regulated way. And we don't want to be disintermediated. What was the answer there?
Right. Well, the technology is probably going to disintermediate them. I don't know if that's a bad thing. I think, if it happens, it happens. It should be part, you know, if it's a better mousetrap, it's a better, more efficient, lower cost to customers and businesses, then that's what's going to happen. I think if you're a regulated bank, if you're an FDIC-insured bank, you get certain benefits from that. You get deposit insurance, you get access to the Federal Reserve. And with that, those benefits, that government safety net, comes an obligation to operate in a safe and sound manner. So I think parts of this business can appropriately be in banks. For instance, custody, where your customer is keeping the market risk, these are highly volatile speculative assets, that's fine. But actually holding them on balance sheet, making markets in them, they're very volatile, very risky. And there are a lot of things that we say really are just too risky and inappropriate for a bank, which is expected to operate in a safe and sound manner. And, you know, there's a lot of things that go on, stupid things that go on outside of banks that are not regulated, and people lose money all the time. And right. You know, if they understand the risk, fine, that's how capitalism works. But it doesn't mean everything has to be in a bank.
Would I be correctly describing your view as saying it's OK for banks to touch crypto activity as long as they are not holding their own cash and capital in the form of cryptocurrencies?
I think that's right. I don't think, you know, and certainly market making should be done in a separate affiliate. It shouldn't be in the insured bank. And that's what we do for securities market making. Yeah, it's not done in insured banks. So, yeah, I think you need to think hard. Regular everyday, you know, people, our deposits, our FDIC insured deposits, what are appropriate uses of those? And holding them in Bitcoin or Dogecoin or whatever, you know, the fad may be and the elevated valuation might be. No, I don't think that's the right use of FDIC insured deposits.
So let's talk. So Paxos and some of the stablecoin companies have tried to say what makes us different is that we have, you know, clear assets which back the value of our stablecoin. They can issue sort of their own documentation attesting to that and that sort of thing. Yes. But regulators, I mean, when we talked to Gary Gordon the other day, he made it sound like they should still come down really hard on stable coins, broadly speaking. So are they going to go with the money market mutual fund framework or, you know, treat them like how do you think they end up kind of being defined within the financial system?
Well, I think they are the closest thing to a government or should be close to a government money market fund in the sense that they represent their stable value, dollar in, dollar out. So they should be in highly liquid, federally backed short-term securities, which is basically what Paxos does and what Coinbase does now, too. Tether's out there and nobody's quite sure what they may be invested in. But I think that's best practice now, and it would be a very small leap to create a structure like a government money market fund that these stablecoin issuers could operate under. I think that would be positive. That is much closer to what the current model is in best practice versus trying to force it into a bank, where then you've really got the FDIC, you know, treat the stablecoins as deposits, you got the FDIC providing stability. Then a bank could take those reserves and lend them wherever. You know, banks do silly things with their money, as we saw during the subprime crisis. So it's not clear to me shoving it into a bank makes sense. I think making it akin to a government money market fund makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
And that's very close to best practice now.
No, that I totally get what you're saying there. And now that I know I can talk to you about stable coins and Paxos and all the rest of it, I'm going to be banging down your door. Sheila, we appreciate by the way, do you personally own Bitcoin?
I do not. I do not own it. Stay away from it. I know people are long Bitcoin but get mad at me when I say it, but I think it's highly speculatively, no, way too risky for me.
All right. Sheila Baird, thank you for your time today. It's great to see you.
Okay. Thanks, Sheila. Bye-bye.
And now, as all industries, but especially restaurants, face higher labor costs and worker shortages, could turning over some tasks to robots save time and money? We'll dig into that next. Plus, celebrity chef Bobby Flay joins us to talk about the labor problems he's seeing in his restaurants, about food price inflation as well. And he's the co-founder of a new company. And wait till you hear who the other co-founder is. It's coming up next. Welcome back. Labor costs are soaring for U.S. companies. This morning, the Employment Cost Index jumped 1.3%, which actually makes its biggest jump since 1996. As workers become harder to find and more expensive to pay, we could see an increase in companies trying to automate more and more tasks. Kate Rogers is looking at how robots are coming to restaurants.
Meet Flippy. Inspire Brands, which owns Buffalo Wild Wings, is testing out Flippy 2 robots, which will make wings in the back of house over the next year. The company says it's more about speed than the labor crunch.
It really is all about how we increase our capacity. And so all of the automation that we are looking at will allow us to unlock that and provide faster food to our guests.
Flippy, made by Miso Robotics, takes over a less desirable task in fast food kitchens and costs up to $3,000 a month.
Flippy Wing solves one of the biggest problems back of house for restaurants, and that's the fry station. The fry station is one of those jobs that's tough to do. It's monotonous, sometimes it's dangerous, and it's pretty repetitive.
Here comes the robot.
While Flippy mans the back of the house, in comes the maitre d' from RichTech, which offers robotic solutions in both the restaurant and hospitality space. Its maitre d' robot cost up to $20,000.
It is going to be assisting a lot of customers with delivering a food, like a food runner. which basically allows servers to serve a lot more tables. Customers get their food faster, and restaurants are able to boost revenue.
Now, on every earnings call, we've heard about labor challenges in the space this quarter. Companies like Domino's and Restaurant Brands International said the challenges were a drag on same-store sales in some cases. Meanwhile, McDonald's is now partnering with IBM to work on further automating the drive-thru, Kelly, with artificial intelligence, which would, of course, alleviate some of these labor pains more broadly once that's implemented.
Last night, I finally had an experience with toast, Kate. And it's amazing. So you're talking more, obviously, in the back of the restaurant. But this is a QR code on your receipt so that you just scan it with your phone. You pay, you leave. You never have to have that kind of back and forth wait for the check. It's amazing. Exactly. I realize they have over $30 billion market value, so I'm the last one to realize this. My question is actually about something totally different now, which is, what is the latest with the unionization effort at Starbucks? Because we saw what happened with the earnings last night. And obviously, these pressures are going to give labor a lot more bargaining power.
Yeah, so Kelly, workers in Buffalo got a preliminary win last night, allowing separate votes to take place in three stores to move ahead. Starbucks had wanted this to be a market-wide vote, which would have involved many more workers. The stock is under some pressure today. As you mentioned, some of those wage hikes it announced will impact its earnings next year. So it is raising pay for its workers. But those workers in Buffalo that are seeking to unionize did get a small victory, and we'll see what happens with the vote. We should get results in early December.
Wow, definitely one to watch. Kate, thank you so much. Our Kate Rogers. Now, while some restaurants are struggling to pass on rising costs to consumers, there's another breed of customers contending with rising costs. It's pets. The pandemic pet boom has boosted the animal care industry, and celebrity chef Bobby Flay is capitalizing on this growing trend, launching his new brand, Made by Nacho, along with his co-founder, Nacho Flay the Cat. The brand available in PetSmart and also as a subscription service through the website. Joining me now in an exchange exclusive is chef, restaurateur, and co-founder of Made by Nacho, Bobby Flay. It's great to have you here, Bobby. Now, this is a pretty competitive space. Do you think you can break through, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, so far we launched about 6 months ago in an exclusive deal with PetSmart in 1,400 stores plus, you know, of course, direct to consumer. And we've seen immediate growth. And basically, week to week, we're growing every week. And, you know, PetSmart has been amazed by our launch. They're so incredibly thrilled. And so are we. And I think what's happened is, you know, because we're so focused on cat, I think that cat parents are feeling like, you know, they're being taken care of and they're being looked after in a different way. And so far it's proven to be incredibly successful.
You do seem like a big cat guy. You know, is it really National Cat Day?
I'm not sure what that means.
I don't know either, but I appreciate the enthusiasm as someone who grew up with cats, and personally, I love them. How big is this business going to go? I mean, you can't invest all your time and energy in all your enterprises all the time. So I would just love to know from a manager's point of view, how you kind of launch something, get it up and running, and then figure out, especially at a time like this, how to spend the rest of your time.
Oh, well, that's a really great question. I mean, and this is no hobby for me. This is number one. This is a business that stems and starts with passion. As you mentioned, I've been a cat guy my whole life, and Nacho it really inspired me. I mean, basically, I had a hard time myself trying to figure out what to feed my cats. And so I sort of took it upon myself to create Made by Nacho. And then I put together literally a team of weapons, some people who have been just amazing. And I use the idea of premiumization of the human food and transferred it over to the cat business. And so the first person I called was a woman named Ellie Truesdell, who was running, she was head of global innovation at Whole Foods. And so I took that experience and my relationship with her and asked her literally on day one to be my partner. And then we started to build the team first, and then we went out and got a person named Julie Nelson, who we made president almost immediately. And she was at Petco for 14 years. So we had the human food business, the cat food or pet food business sort of covered. And then just recently, after, you know, about 6 months of launching, we saw that the growth of our business was really taking off. I hired a CEO. I was the acting CEO, but then we hired what I would call a real CEO named Tessa Gould. She comes from Kinship, which is a Mars company. And as you know, Mars is one of the biggest pet food companies
Absolutely.
In the world.
Yeah.
So I really have a team of really innovative people who are making, this is a real business, Kelly. It's not just a hobby. It's definitely a passion, but it's for real.
I mean, I might try some. You've got the bone broth, nacho signature ingredient that adds flavor, collagen, and hydration. You know, pet food is really, it's coming full circle. Let me ask you about this. And I know there have been maybe the Borgata restaurant, maybe that one closed, but you guys have operations in multiple states. Obviously, you've got exposure to Vegas. You've got exposure to New York City. You've got exposure to a lot of these markets. Is an effort like this, a direct-to-consumer launch, a step away from a restaurant space that has like a zillion challenges right now, or am I reading too much into it?
I think we have a zillion challenges everywhere. And one of the things that makes Made by Nacho a nimble company is my involvement. When you think about chefs, we're not always able to get the ingredients that we want at the price we want, but we still have to serve delicious food. So we're not always putting, black truffles and caviar on everything to taste good, but we have to be innovative. And so with, of course there are, concerns, and there's definitely challenges with the supply chain in every business, the restaurant business, the pet food business. We're all basically in the same pond, but being able, using my experience by, feeding people for the last 30 years, whether it's in my restaurants or getting, dinner to their table by watching my TV shows on Food Network, et cetera, that's where I can really be helpful in Made by Nacho, and really, using the things that are available to us in the very best way so that they're delicious and nutritious, and the cat parent is happy all around.
I was almost going to joke, don't divert the supply chain to cats right now, but that's not the point here. Last question, Bobby, is we just saw, I don't know if you're able to watch, Kate Rogers did this package where we saw robots moving through restaurants, and we know the pressures these spaces are under. I just can't see your restaurants going in that direction, but maybe, how is this all going to evolve? Are we really going to see this kind of experience?
I frankly, I hope not. I mean, I understand. I'm all for innovation, and I'm all for, for tech moving things forward. But there is something about the experience where, it's person to person. And when I heard you, I actually heard the end of your interview. And when I heard you say, you can kind of get out of the restaurant quick without actually having to deal with other people. There's an intangible of customer service. And that's one of the things that whether it's in my restaurant business or Made by Nacho, customer service is king. And I think if you lose that humanization of it all, I think, you can be in a little trouble.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. And I thought the same thing myself, even as I was, lamenting or enjoying what was taking place. Bobby, again, congrats on the launch of Made by Nacho. Happy National Cat Day.
Same to you, Kelly.
Thanks for joining me today, Bobby Flay. Still ahead, supply chain pain. Thousands of shipping containers are stuck at ports, full of stuff unable to be unloaded. We'll tell you about the new plan to get that cargo off ships and out of the way, and ask the most important question, will it actually work? Welcome back, everybody. We've talked a lot about supply chain bottlenecks, and a major source of the problem is this congestion at the ports. In Los Angeles and Long Beach, 60,000 containers are waiting. If shipping companies don't unload them by Sunday, they will be hit with a $100 per day penalty for each full container. It's part of the Biden administration's plan to unclog the supply chain. CNBC's Lorianne LaRocco is here. Lorianne, it's great to see you again. So are they going to meet this deadline? And is it just, is the financial penalty enough to resolve this problem?
The penalty definitely is not going to resolve the problem. And in fact, there's no way they're going to be able to make this. And they're like, the real-time indicator that we're seeing is the 82 ships that we're seeing waiting outside of those ports. And those are at anchor. And in 3 days' time, you're going to have an additional 21 container vessels. So when you look at these 60,000 vessels, right, comprised, that is $2.66 billion in trade that is just sitting there. And Gene Sirocco told me, he's like, listen, the carriers knew starting on Monday, you had to get this stuff out of there. And it's not. And in fact, 30% of all the containers that you see at that port, they've been there for over 13 days. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, they've normally been out in 4 days.
Wow. Okay. So now my understanding is about 2/3 of the merchandise moves via truck, maybe 1/3 by rail. Yes. So the real issue is this kind of bottleneck with the trucking companies. Is that the real issue? I mean, who's the responsible party for actually getting that couple billion dollars in cargo that you mentioned moving through the U.S. economy?
Well, according to the ports, the ultimate responsibility is the carriers, and that's why they are being fined. They are on the bills of lading. They're the ones that are supposed to shepherd these products from point A to point B, and they have to make sure that the middleman, the truck, and the rail get that product. The rail is right now at 4.5 days of past dead time. The truckers, it's hard because they've got full chassis. They can't drop off. They're empty. So it's a conundrum, and it's not just one problem. It's the whole system that is really in lockdown.
So if that's the case and they now have to pay $100 a day for for the system's breakdown, that cost, will that ultimately get passed along to consumers? And again, then how else can this problem be resolved?
You know, that is like the billion-dollar question. And in fact, it is definitely going to be passed over to the consumer. A lot of people are saying, oh, my gosh, will it, won't, and a lot of hand-wringing. Zim Integrated Shipping sent out a letter yesterday to customers saying, hey, listen, starting on Monday, this is the new surcharge. Maersk said, well, we have to wait to see what happens with the Port of L.A. They're having a meeting as we speak right now on what they're going to do with the penalty, how they roll it out. But here's the catch. Not all contracts are created equal. There are some contracts out there that there are clauses in there that prohibit new surcharges. And Maersk told me, hey, listen, we've got some clients that actually have these clauses in there, but not everybody has them.
Interesting. Well, and again, a couple of important days to watch. Lorianne, thank you so much for following this for us. Our Lorianne LaRocco. Investors are still waiting for the post-pandemic comeback of the cruise industry. Royal Caribbean losing money and missing on revenue in their quarter. And the stock is flat over the past 6 months. We're going to talk to the CEO about what's got him optimistic for 2022 right after this. Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. It's been an up-and-down year for the cruise industry, battling with so many forces to get their ships back in the water. Today, Royal Caribbean predicting a brighter 2022. While their losses did widen last quarter, the company says they expect to be cash flow profitable by the end of next year. Joining us now is Seema Modi with the CEO of Royal Caribbean, Richard Fain. Seema?
Thank you, Kelly. And Richard, welcome back. I think that was the big takeaway from your earnings call, looking to be profitable by spring of next year. I'm wondering, what are bookings looking like going into the holiday season?
Well, bookings mostly this year continued to be weak as people are looking at 2021 and didn't have time to book earlier on. The holiday will be much better, of course. It always is. But next year, the bookings are remarkably strong.
There seems to be this race to get as many ships back to sea between Royal Caribbean, Carnival, and Norwegian. You're at 65% capacity, aiming to get to 100% by the end of this year. At a time, Richard, when we're watching these ports around the world, there's shortages, there's bottlenecks, there's logistic issues. How are those supply chain issues affecting the cruise industry?
Well, fortunately, like any other business, every business in the world today is finding supply chain challenges. But we prepared a lot of this in advance. So it's really not interfering with our basic business. And as you said, we've been very successful. So far already have been bringing back almost two-thirds of our capacity. And we really wanted to get that flywheel going. It was really important that we could show to the public that the ships are operating, they're reliable, it's business as usual. And that's happening. And that, we think that flywheel will give us a very good start. We're already seeing it in our bookings for next year, and we think as we enter the key booking period in January, it'll be even stronger.
Yeah, your stock has rallied off the pandemic lows, but recently it's been trading in a narrow range. I think there are questions around pricing power, Richard. We are in this environment of travel inflation. If you look at the hotels, rates are up 40% year over year. Car rentals, a similar story. What about in the cruise industry? Can you start to raise ticket prices?
Well, we did say that our prices are up, in fact. We're not seeing the spikes that you're seeing in some other parts of the travel business, but that's because our real focus is on getting everything back. We don't want to get very high prices on a small proportion of our fleet. We want to get good prices on the whole fleet. And we think the pricing power is there, and the forward bookings tend to give us support for that projection.
What about staffing? Because right now, the labor shortage issue in the hospitality sector is certainly significant when I talk to the CEOs of Hilton, among other hospitality operators. But most of your staff is coming from overseas. So does that insulate you from the labor shortage?
It certainly does, actually. I think that and the fact that our jobs are seen as so desirable. So we've really had essentially no problem in attracting the kind of talent. The people that provide the service are what makes the company so successful. They are the ones that the guests love. They are the ones that bring them coming back. And fortunately, we've had no difficulty recruiting. And as, again, as I say, I think it's because we're just seen as such an attractive job for people all over the world.
In efforts to reduce debt on your balance sheet, where are you at there, Richard?
Well, we took on a great deal of debt as we went through the pandemic, but now we're in the process of reducing, especially some of the more expensive debt. So we just did something to replace our expensive debt that we took on during the crisis with cheaper debt at today's prices, 5.5%. And we're really looking to get completely out of all the crisis debt before, or COVID debt, as we would sometimes refer to it, really before, in a year and a half or 2 years.
Okay, we'll be tracking that progress. As always, Richard, great to see you. Thank you for joining us. Richard Fain, the CEO and Chairman of Royal Caribbean. Kelly.
Our thanks to Richard Sima. And to, hey, Sima, is there Royal Caribbean, that 274-day cruise we're talking about
later?
Yes,
we are talking about it tonight on The Shep Show with you, Kelly. 274 days around the world. If you want to join me one day, maybe we can go. We'll see if CNBC will let us remote in.
Yeah, it sounded pretty good. I'll see you later, Sima. Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for tuning into The Exchange today.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day. Same time, same place.
Imagine earning a degree that prepares you with real skills for the real world. Capella University's programs teach skills relevant to your career so you can apply what you learn right away. Learn how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu.